Welcome to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
Just so you know, you can podcast this show. Just go to your app and, you can podcast Think Wing Radio so you can catch up on all the old episodes. Just in terms of general information, do always remember to make sure you're registered to vote and you haven't been expunged. Also, the Harris County Clerk's office, to the best of my knowledge, is still physically closed, but will take phone calls and emails, and you can do most of your business through the county clerk online. Right. I'm scrolling. Okay.
Well, let's talk about when this program was recorded and what that means.
Oh, yes. This program has now been recorded on Sunday at 12:30 a.m., technically,
yes.
Sunday, or Saturday night, if you just want to sort of be broad and general about it.
Well, yeah.
I mean, to me, tomorrow is whenever the next time is I wake up.
Fair.
Anything else is just too complicated.
Yeah.
Okay, and well, remember, July 15th is the new tax deadline, and the next primary runoff in Harris County is July 14th. A connection,
yes,
we just recently made. So tax,
yes,
day is the day after primary day.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it should be noted that while this is normally a call-in show, you cannot call in today because we are pre-recording this. There will be no one to pick up your call.
And to be fair, I did say that we were pre-recorded on Sunday, May 10th at 12:32 a.m.
Okay.
But your point is still well taken.
Yes, you didn't say that they couldn't call in. Anyway, we're
they
bickering
can call,
now.
But there's no one there to answer, so please don't call.
We're bickering now. We
are bickering. Yeah, we're getting to be the Bickersons. Okay, so interesting little tidbits of news. As most of you who are regular listeners know, I try not to talk so much about the stuff that's sort of dominating the news because I feel like I can't usually contribute anything to that. So I do what I like to call either below the fold or inside the paper stuff. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. So the first thing that I think merits some brief mention is the headline on CNN, House Coronavirus Oversight Panel asks five companies to return loans meant for small businesses. Now, you've probably heard stories about large companies taking millions of dollars in very generous loan terms, much of which,
yeah,
may end up being forgiven, and then a lot of small businesses that could have done great things with far fewer dollars got frozen out.
Yeah.
So this is, I think, the beginning of House oversight. There are five specific companies mentioned: MyMedics Group, Evo Transportation and Energy Services, Universal Stainless and Alloy Products, Quantum Corp, and Gulf Island Fabrication. I'm not sure I've heard of any of those.
Yeah, I don't think these are exactly household brands, but, I mean, that's the kind of company that would be big enough to cause problems like this.
And small enough to be maybe a little below the radar.
That's true.
So, yeah, so at least, you know, the House, the Democrats in the House are trying to do something in regards to clawing back some of this money for the Paycheck Protection Program. So, you know, more power to them. Hope that they actually get something accomplished.
I do actually want to question, I don't know if you know enough to answer this or not, but this is phrased as a request, it looks like. And it does say that the panel has set a deadline of Monday. If the company opts not to send the money back, The panel requests that the company produce documents and communications related to the loan. Is this something they can actually enforce in any way, shape, or form? Or is this just, please give the money back, be nice?
Well, as I have come to understand these things, and that's an important caveat.
Yeah.
They typically, when Congress is doing an investigation, and the law is much like this when they're doing an investigation, they will often make a request. Would you like to come down to the station and talk to us? Well, you know, we can just arrest you and bring you down. And I think this is similar to that. I think as sort of a courtesy, they are first requested to produce this information.
Right.
And then if they don't produce it voluntarily, if they can justify it, they will then issue subpoenas, because you can have congressional subpoenas, which are supposed to be obeyed, believe it or not.
Right.
And of course, at that point, the companies could contest it, or they could simply produce the information under subpoena. You know, we can get into all the different kinds of evasions. You know, it's not executive privilege in this particular case. They're not government employees in this particular case. Who knows what this world is going to look like when a subpoena is issued?
But there is teeth to this, basically, is what you're saying.
There are potential teeth to this, yes.
Okay.
So it starts off as a courtesy request, and if the courtesy is declined, then they can actually do a teething request, if you will.
Okay.
So that's that. The next little bit I thought I would bring up, because it's sort of on the theme of the world changing, maybe permanently, in ways that can't immediately be predicted, although some of this now is becoming more obvious. The headline from Engadget.com is, Google and Facebook employees have been notified they can work from home for the rest of the year. Now, Amazon is allowing HQ employees at least until October 2nd to work from home. I think there was Microsoft also is allowing employees to work from home when possible for the foreseeable future, without a date actually plugged into that.
Well, Microsoft, it says, gives them the option of working remotely until the end of October. That's from the article.
Let's see. Amazon says October 2nd. Now, I guess what I summarized it, because I did put brackets around it. Amazon is allowing their employees to work from home for the foreseeable future where feasible, is how I abbreviated it.
Yes, but it's a little bit lower down.
I might have missed it.
Yeah.
Okay. So in any case, though, the point is that working from an office is a thing that is becoming increasingly optional for a lot of workers.
Yeah.
Which is going to have an impact not only on workers, but on bottom lines for company, on commercial real estate, on utilities. You know, we talked in a previous show, maybe last week, about the fact that carbon emissions are down about 5.5%. Because so much energy is put into creating electricity.
Yes.
And it's not so much that we're using electricity. We're just using it differently at different times.
Yeah.
So this will impact that, which is actually a good thing, because it makes it easier to balance load. So that becomes a thing.
Yeah.
And, of course, it affects companies in terms of their bottom line, their costs and profits, because smaller offices, or maybe rent a office. You know, there are a lot of professionals that share suites, where they will have an office, but they'll share things like libraries, and they'll share things like secretarial assistants, executive assistants, switchboards. So you might have a lawyer doing like a one person, but they're in a suite that allows them to replicate the functions of a law firm.
Right.
This is a thing that could end up becoming more common for larger businesses that used to have large offices with many people. And now it may be like, well, maybe there will be suites that offices, that businesses will rent one day a month or one day a week, maybe for a few hours, so that they can get some meetings done, some brainstorming synergies done, and then go back out and do their work from home in many cases. All this stuff is like, this is sort of the early stages of significant changes.
Yeah.
So I'm finding this because I am retired and once removed, I can look at this sort of as an interesting thing. I have amazing sympathy for people that are actually having to endure and live through this systemic, gut-wrenching change right now, yeah. both financially and professionally.
Yeah.
It's going to be traumatic. Okay. I think in on the topic that we're probably going to spend a lot more time on, there are two stories that I feel are kind of tied together. And both of them, I believe, came from you, Andrew, more or less, directly or indirectly.
Indirectly, one of them directly, the other one, yeah.
So the first one is from Yahoo News, and it's headlined, Armed Activists Escort Black Lawmaker to Michigan's Capitol After Coronavirus Protest Attended by White Supremacists.
Yeah, it's important to focus on the first two words of that,
armed activists. And this is something to kind of keep in your head as I go through this. A Michigan lawmaker returned to the Michigan State Capitol on Wednesday the 6th with an armed security detail. Notice it's an armed security detail. Following a coronavirus lockdown protest at the building last week attended by white supremacists and militia groups. Representative Sarah Anthony, a Democrat whose district is in the capital city of Lansing, told Yahoo News in an interview that her security detail, made up of local Black and Latino activists, came together because the armed protesters bearing white supremacist symbols represented a, quote, different level of terror. And according to Anthony, the protest was different because many of the demonstrators were armed. They stormed inside the building. Some of them had Confederate flags and swastikas. And she found it, quote, extraordinarily triggering for me as an African-American woman. Hmm. Now, there's a YouTube of some of this, and, you know, I've always got the link to the article on my blog page, and I have a separate link to the YouTube that is embedded in the article, if that's all you want to see. But I thought this was really interesting because, you know, we've talked, especially last week, I think, we spent some time on this, that the Second Amendment is currently basically a white person's amendment. A black person open carrying a long gun is going to be killed by the cops. We've pretty much established that now.
Yeah.
A black person carrying a concealed handgun, as soon as a cop recognizes he's carrying it, is pretty much going to be killed by the cops. We've pretty much established that now.
And weapons are often planted on suspects that have been killed unjustly, and that's been used as a defense of the action that the officer took.
That's true, but often multiracial. I mean, you can talk about the predominance of people of color having been shot, but that's been done regardless of race. It's just, you know, whatever. In any case, the point here is that while we've been talking for quite a while, and Egberto first pointed this out to me, Egberto Willis, that the Second Amendment right now is pretty much a white person's amendment. It's not legally restricted to white people. So now here you have a prominent instance of people of color taking up arms, basically reciprocating what the white right-wing extremists have done. And as a group, there is power in numbers with weapons acting as a security detail for this state legislator.
Yeah.
This is, and I'm not saying this is a bad thing in its context, but this is the kind of escalation you get when people start waving around guns.
And it's a special kind of escalation that happens when there is significant inequality in who can wave around guns as well, I think. Because I think if there was more, you know, fairness, I guess is the word to use. It doesn't feel like the right word, but if there was more fairness in
equality.
Yeah. If there was more equality in, you know, who was allowed to own and carry weapons without being stopped by police, without being, you know, questioned.
Summarily executed in some cases.
Then this particular conflict may have been resolved in a different way, or it may have been the white supremacists may not have come armed, or, you know, the white supremacists may not have shown up at all. You know, it's, I think there is something specific here about this specific instance that would be different if, you know, if the law was actually fair.
Well, I want to make two points in this. The first one is, I am an old white guy mm-hmm. who has had my metaphorical come to Jesus moment on this issue. Mm. So that's where I'm coming from personally. Mm-hmm. The other thing I want to point out is, this was a security detail, so-called,
yes.
of armed Black and Latino activists, which comes to the strength in numbers issue. If she had had one Black man with a long gun escorting
yeah.
her into the Capitol, it's entirely possible, I'm not saying it would have happened, but it's entirely possible that Capitol security would have told him to put down his weapon, turn around, maybe shot him if he made anything they interpreted as a false move.
Yeah.
The fact that there was a group of them changed that calculus, I believe.
Yes. And
that's why there was a group of them.
Yeah. And in that, you know, possible scenario where there was only one of them, I honestly don't know if she had vouched for the one person who was her escort. I don't know if her vouching for this person would have helped at all, because and that's one of the concerning things about this, is that if you feel like you need this sort of help and you request it, and the police or another, you know, government security force show up and, you know, enter the situation, you can't necessarily rely on them, you know, stopping to understand the situation, stopping to see whether the person who is being protected wants this protection or not.
Well, I'm going to insert a couple of things here.
Sure.
First of all, we don't know if she requested police protection.
That's true. We don't.
We don't know if they offered police protection and she declined it and preferred to go this route. So those are unknowns based on the content of this article.
Right.
I think that the other point you were making, which is if she had explained,
yeah.
I think we have seen what happens when unarmed Black people or people of color who are with armed people of color try to explain, that doesn't stop people from being shot.
Exactly. That was my main point, is that that's concerning, that there's not, you know, people who are trying to de-escalate a situation are not listened to or ignored.
And it might not matter whether that explainer is white or not.
I
think what they see is a Black or brown person carrying a weapon.
Yeah.
And of course, what's been odd to me for quite some time is even Black or Latino police officers seem to react the same way as white police officers, which is
yes.
an intriguing police culture thing that probably deserves investigation.
Yes, I think it's an argument in favor of the argument that, you know, Black and Latinx and other, you know, people of color activists have made, in that this is not a problem of one or two bad apples. This is a systemic structural issue. And until
sometimes in some police departments more than others, I don't want to paint them all with one brush.
I mean, you're probably right statistically, but I don't know if that's particularly useful in trying to address the problem.
It's prevalent enough that it's obviously a police culture problem.
Yes.
You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson, and we are talking about the stuff that maybe is being buried by the COVID virus news that still is worthy of some attention.
Yeah.
Just FYI, you can visit my blog at thinkwingradio.com, and you can go to the post for particular shows and see the various links I'm working off of. You can follow me on Twitter at thinkwingradio.com. I'm sorry, at thinkwingradio. The website is thinkwingradio.com, and on Facebook, still Thinkwing Radio.
Yes. I have Twitter at DominateI. That is not how it's pronounced, but the pronunciation is in my bio.
I'm sorry.
I'm trying to shorten it.
We've had this discussion so many times. Why do we care how it's pronounced if they can spell it right and find it?
Because it matters to me. In fact, actually, that reminds me. I actually am not spelling it well enough. It's Dominate EYE, at Dominate EYE, because some people think it's Dominate and then the letter I, and then that's not
precisely.
Right.
Precisely. Yes, so. Because spelling, as in many things in life, matters.
Yeah, okay. So anyway, to sum up, my Twitter...
I just can't help it. I always get in his face on this. And I really shouldn't.
To sum up, my Twitter is at Dominate EYE. Follow me there.
Okay. Fair enough. The other story that we wanted to talk about is actually from an NBC affiliate, WECT-TV, in Pender County, North Carolina. And the story is entitled, Two People, including a former deputy, are to be charged in terrorizing incident. This is actually a follow-up to a story they did the previous day, May 7th, two people, including a now former New Hanover County Sheriff's deputy, will be charged with crimes in relation to an incident where a family says it was terrorized by a large group of people in Pender County last week, according to the district attorney, Ben David. Pender County Sheriff Alan Cutler and DA David announced the charges on Friday, 5 days after the incident happened. In a letter addressed to the DA's office on Thursday, the attorney for these folks, James Lee, claimed that an armed group of people, all white, knocked on the door of Monica Shepherd late Sunday night, or that Sunday. She was asleep. Her son Damien, a high school senior, was awake and playing video games, and he answered the door. Attorney Lee said that the group...
The group demanded to know information
about a young missing girl. Yes. They were apparently looking for an individual named Josiah, who lived next door to the Shepherds, but left the neighborhood a month earlier, apparently unbeknownst to this group, a.k.a. mob. Attorney Lee said Damien identified himself several times. The group continued to press for information he did not have, and among the people on Shepherd's porch, the family's porch, was a person carrying an assault weapon and another with a shotgun, and also part of the group was this off-duty member of the New Hanover County Sheriff's Office, Deputy Jordan Keita, who was assigned to the detention division.
He was in uniform as well.
He was in uniform and armed.
Yes.
So, you know, this was a literal terrorist event.
Yeah,
this was, and to be fair, I want to give a little credit here because this was pointed to me by Andrew. It was also pointed to me by a post that Andrew sent me by Hund on Destiny on Tumblr, and that directed me to the original stories. And then I even called WECT and spoke to the reporter Anna Phillips, who gave me a little bit more background that apparently. This arrest information came from the sheriff's press release, where he said that he wanted to provide an update for members of the media. Sheriff Cutler and District Attorney David announced that charges were being brought against Jordan Keita, a former New Hanover County Sheriff's detention officer, and Robert Austin Wood, pursuant to an investigation in the Avondale neighborhood this past weekend. Keita is being charged with failure to discharge his duties of office, which would have been, you know, to like control the mob, forcible trespass, and breaking and entering because he put his foot in the door in order to prevent Ms. Shepherd from closing the door and ending the interaction.
Yes.
Mr. Wood is being charged with going armed to the terror of the public, which is an interesting charge. What I think is interesting is that apparently before these charges were brought, you had 10 attorneys in the DA's office actually going over constitutional law and precedent to decide what charges to bring and how to frame them.
Yes.
So it may have been public pressure as much as anything else, but they did end up taking this very seriously.
Yes.
And I think in terms of the way they framed their charges, it almost sounds like the charges themselves may be a little precedent setting.
I mean, because this is surely not the only instance of something like this happening. And
well,
I hope that this
arm to the terror of the public.
Yeah.
Really interesting charge. I've never heard of anything remotely like that. And arguably anybody who walks into a Walmart with an open carry weapon, assuming they're permitted in at the door, maybe no one wants to fight with them. Mm. That could be argued as going armed to the terror of the public. Anybody I see carrying a gun in public that doesn't have the color of office, as far as I'm concerned, they're going armed to the terror of the public.
Well, I hope that this does set a precedent for this kind of racial terror, basically, because, you know, it doesn't always take this exact form, but there are plenty of instances around this country every day when, you know, black people feel genuinely fear for their lives because, you know, people are confronting them for something that they didn't do or something that they think they've done. And it's just it's intolerable, frankly.
You know, on a totally separate note, there is a movie called Green Book,
okay,
which is based on a true story, and Green Book is also based on a true thing. So the title comes from that. The Green Book used to be a tour guide for African Americans that would tell them towns they should avoid,
right,
places they could stay without being harassed,
right,
restaurants that would serve them,
right.
This was a real thing. This was essentially the AAA guidebook for African Americans.
Yeah.
If they wanted to travel safely. I know people of color who still will not drive in certain states. They just won't.
Yeah. And there are certain towns around the nation that are called sundown towns where even if the majority of them, I think, have, you know, changed their have enacted ordinances to try and get rid of this reputation that they have. But, you know, these were towns where it was not safe to be a black person in after the sun went down. You could get killed for it. And there are these towns quite, you know, reasonably still are avoided by black people today because it's just, it's such a horrible thing, and it inspired so much fear in them.
There are towns that still have a reputation that they carry, you know, whether they're proud of it or would like to see it go away, that have a history of lynchings and harassment and jailing people of color for passing through, ticketing them essentially for driving while being black. There are towns that still have that reputation. Some of them don't mind it at all.
Yes. Yeah. And
there was a story a few years ago. I think it was in either like Arizona or New Mexico or Nevada, one of those states. A black woman with a couple of children in the back seat was stopped by a police officer for some reason, and he wanted her to exit the car, and she didn't. And at a certain point, now they were on a fairly deserted stretch of road. It was blacktop, two lanes, but there was, it's not like it was in a town or anything. This was sort of in the middle of nowhere, which is what a lot of the American Southwest is like.
Right.
She declined to get out of the car, ended up putting the car in gear, stepping on the gas.
Mm-hmm.
One of the cops did a sort of cop movie thing and tried to fire at the tires. Now, mind you, she had two kids in the back seat.
Yeah.
Okay. She ended up speeding into a town, followed by the police, pulling into a motel in town before stopping and essentially surrendering to the police. This was a national news story at the time, and it came out after some reporting that the reason she had done what she did the way she did it was because she feared being in a situation with cops, especially with her kids, in a fairly deserted stretch of road without any witnesses.
Yeah.
and that she broke away from the police and sped to the town so that she would be at a lobby of a motel in a place where there were people, where there were cars, where if the police tried to do anything or did anything, that there would be witnesses.
Yeah.
So, and that witnesses might deter them from anything they might otherwise have done.
Yes.
Now, whether this was a fair assessment on her part or not, of course, a guy trying to shoot out tires, which is something they don't train you to do, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, this is a reality of mind for people of color. You can argue whether she did right or wrong. Certainly, she technically violated the law. But did she violate the law because she, in fact, felt threatened?
And
she didn't feel safe with the police.
Yeah, and what could have happened had she not done that as well?
On a fairly deserted stretch of road.
Yeah, these are things you have to think about when you're thinking about the morality of this situation, because you can't just think about the legality.
Well, there's always the distinction, or should be, not often enough, the distinction between the letter of the law and the spirit of the law.
Yeah.
And, of course, that is often where a judge's discretion comes in when it gets to court. And, you know, again, a serious digression of point. That's why it matters who gets appointed to the bench, or who gets, in some cases, elected to the bench.
Yes.
Because in the cases where judges do have options, an interpretation, that the kind of person that judge is, even if they are trying to be fair as they see it, a judge can't divorce themselves from what they believe, who they are, what they've experienced. They can do their best if they're honest about it, but even doing their best when they're honest about it doesn't mean they don't come into a case with some subtle biases.
Right.
You know, whether it's a hard on crime bias, or it's a, well, society has some responsibility here bias, they come in with biases.
Right.
And the cops, when they stop somebody, you know, I've been stopped a number of times as a white guy, so my experience cannot be compared. But I don't know what the experience that cop is bringing with him. I've met some cops that were very courteous to me as a white guy. I've met some cops that were real jerks, is a polite word. They've been white cops. They've been black cops. They've been Latino or how do you pronounce it? Latinx?
Latinx. But there's another term that I use, which we can go over later. But I think.
Try it now.
Well, okay. Latine.
Unless you'd rather not.
Latine, which is more in line with how Spanish works, because Latinx is a little bit awkward to say in native Spanish, you know. Latine.
I mean, I understand Latino and Latina are technically different things. I think Latino has become an English generic, but apparently many Hispanics are still unhappy with it, which is why some of them came up with Latinx.
Yes.
So now Latine, explain that one to me. Talk about a digression.
Well, yeah. It's a gender neutral term. It's like Latinx is supposed to be.
Is it the letter A?
No, it's the letter E.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Haven't heard that one.
Yeah, it's relatively it's relatively new, I think. But it sounds
so things become known by being used. If it's used, become known.
Yeah,
we're all learning as we go.
Yeah, I just don't want to say that, you know, this is the new way to say it, because I don't have that authority. Because I'm not part of the
group. Well, none of us do. It ends up being as people use it and as people hope it is used. So, do we have anything else to cover on the white versus non-white gun carrying issue, or
We were talking about the potential for the 14th Amendment's equal treatment clause and how that might affect the Second Amendment.
And we've actually tried to do some research on it. You actually went to a membership database.
I went to
from school.
Yeah, my college's library database online sort of thing that we have access to. Yeah, and I didn't find any scholarly articles or news articles or, you know, official government documents or anything like that, really, or law journal articles for that matter, addressing this question. I think the closest I found was an instance in a law journal of someone trying to use the equal treatment clause to defend their right to concealed carry in a park where children were present. And I forget where this happened, but the parks...
What was the argument that a white person could carry a gun in that on those premises, but he could not?
Well, the race of the person was not mentioned is the thing.
Which makes it sort of irrelevant for our purposes of discussion.
Yes, which is why I'm saying it's the closest I could find, but it's not exactly relevant.
Okay. Basically, yeah. The issue that Andrew is talking about that we discussed last week on the show that we've had a lot of discussion about off air is the Second Amendment supposedly gives you relatively unfettered right to carry firearms.
Yes.
The 14th Amendment requires equal treatment under the law as it has been interpreted. It's a post-Civil War amendment, I think, from about 1870. Now, that the 14th Amendment at one time, and even to this day, has been used to defend the Second Amendment, to defend the right to carry. And the contention that I've been wrestling with, that Andrew and I have been discussing, that we have both independently been researching, has the equal treatment clause ever been used against the Second Amendment? Mm-hmm. And the reasoning is that a black person carrying a weapon or a person of color carrying a weapon in public is much more likely to be assaulted by law authorities than a white person carrying a weapon in public, mm-hmm. which would seem to represent unequal treatment under the law mm-hmm. as practice, not necessarily as written.
Right.
Now, in court, my impression has been that the letter of the law is not always the thing that a judge will decide a case based upon.
Right.
That they will look at, say, Congress's intent or the legislature's intent. Mm-hmm. And if the intent of the Second Amendment of the Constitution is the right to bear arms, mm-hmm. the 14th Amendment would seem to require that right to bear arms be treated equally in all cases, meaning you shouldn't be under increased threat of death by public officials if you are not a white person and you're carrying a weapon.
Right.
We can't find an instance where this has either been an argument made or a legal argument pursued, which either means it's a really stupid idea or for some reason it hasn't been thought of to the point of being pursued.
Yeah.
And we still don't know which.
Yeah, yeah. And it raises some interesting questions about the legality of the Second Amendment as currently written.
Currently enforced and interpreted. It's written the way it's written, and it's part of the Constitution, and a part of the Constitution cannot be ruled unconstitutional.
Yes. But I think it actually does question it as it's written as well, because the 14th Amendment is, I think the intent was to guarantee that the law would treat everyone equally as written. I don't necessarily think that they could intend to, I mean, they could probably hope, I think, but I don't think they could intend to say that enforcement or as actually, you know, experienced can be treated equally. I think they could hope for that. But I don't know if they could actually like legislate that. So,
well, the question, what it comes down to, is whether the 14th Amendment can be used as a basis upon which the Second Amendment must be reinterpreted.
Yes.
In light of the lack of equal treatment under the law for people carrying weapons based on their color.
Yes. And but I do wonder if the Second Amendment complies with the 14th Amendment insofar as the way it is currently written, it meets those theoretical, you know, there's nothing in the text of the amendment that would suggest that it would apply to people any differently. So,
well, I don't think that framing is right, because the Second Amendment can't apply to the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment, in whatever way it might, supersedes the Second Amendment.
Yeah, I
do. So the question is, and I'm sorry if I'm interrupting, the question then becomes, as the Second Amendment is interpreted in light of the 14th Amendment, mm-hmm. is it being interpreted according to the Constitution?
Right. Okay. I was more talking about, I mean, I wasn't trying to apply the Second Amendment to the 14th Amendment or anything like that. That wasn't my intention. But I was trying to talk about, is the way the Second Amendment is...
Exactly.
Yeah.
The way the Second Amendment is written is irrelevant to the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment supersedes the Second Amendment, so it only affects interpretation of the Second, if it does at all.
I know, but I'm not saying it would... Okay, we're talking in circles here. I'm not saying it would change how the 14th Amendment works. I'm saying, does the language of the Second Amendment comply with the 14th Amendment based on language alone?
Okay, and as you say, we are talking in circles, but I think that that's the wrong framing to start with.
Okay.
I don't think the language of the Second Amendment is relevant to the 14th Amendment. I think the language of the 14th Amendment is a superseding amendment then should affect how the Second Amendment is interpreted subsequently.
Okay.
I mean, I think it's a serious philosophical difference between the two, and maybe a legal difference as well.
Yeah. I'm just trying to wonder how it might be, you know, defended or how it might be argued that there's no problem at all because
and that's text, where we agree.
Yeah, because I'm thinking, you know, one could make the argument that there's no problem because the text does not specify that it should apply any differently to specific people. So,
you're talking about the Second Amendment, doesn't?
Second.
Well, of course, the Second Amendment was written at a time when most black people were slaves. So
yes.
It wasn't even considered that there might be a difference in treatment between a white person carrying a gun and a black person carrying a gun, except insofar as a black person carrying a gun was a danger to slave owners.
Yes, and so from intent, you could definitely say that it's not compliant with the 14th Amendment in that case.
Hmm. Okay, there might be some ground for discussion in that particular context. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson. You can support KPFT by going to kpft.org. You can follow what's going on at the station, which currently physically in the station isn't much, but you can see what kinds of events are being planned, what kinds of paths are being considered. You can also help to support the station if you are in a position to do so by clicking on the donate link. You can download programs. You can even podcast programs, including this one. So there are a lot of things you can do at the website for KPFT. It's kpft.org. And I suggest you pay it a visit and see what's going on with the station, not only in terms of the current COVID virus, but in terms of what the station is doing generally and what the future might hold.
Yeah.
There's a lot to be found there. I think as long as I feel like we've sort of talked through this issue, there is an interesting story that was published on polygraph.info that 30 years, this is the headline, 30 years after admitting World War II massacre of Polish POWs, the Katyn Memorial plaques were removed in Russia. This is kind of a historical thing that after the Nazis invaded Western Poland and the Soviets invaded Eastern Poland, there was a massacre of Polish military officers and intellectuals. And at the time, there was a dispute between Hitler and Stalin who had committed it.
Mm.
And subsequently, historically, there has been a debate over whether it was the Nazis or the Soviets who committed it.
Mm.
Now, the story is kind of posted like a Snopes.com thing. You know, is it true or is it false that Russia admitted in 1990 that the Soviet Union's world, that it was the Soviet Union that committed the mass execution of Poles?
Right.
And the story, I think the headline is a little weird because it says false, that Russia admitted in 1990 the Soviet Union's World War II mass execution of the Poles. But the story goes on to say that on April 13th of 1990, the Soviet government released a statement to the state-owned news agency TASS accepting responsibility for the execution of 22,000 Poles, calling the massacre, quote, one of the most heinous crimes of Stalinism. But On April 28, 2010, Russia's then-president Dmitry Medvedev ordered the release of the original Katyn documents, including the lists of the executions and the execution orders. So that sounds to me like it was true that Russia did admit in 1990 that it was Soviet troops that committed the execution. Okay. So I find the article itself a little confusing.
Yeah.
But I think the information contained in the article, insofar as it does, it speaks for itself. Mm. So for people not familiar with history, there's the invasion of Poland, which occurred on September 1st, 1939. There was the occupation of Western Poland by the Nazis, Eastern Poland by the Soviets. The Soviets never gave back that territory, by the way, at the end of the war.
Mm.
They incorporated Eastern Poland into the Soviet Union. And when the nation of Poland was recreated, they simply moved the borders west. So Eastern Poland is now what was then Western Poland. And Western Poland is now what was then Eastern Germany. Ah, you didn't know that, did you?
I did not.
Yeah, they basically moved the whole country westward so that the Soviets could keep what Stalin had taken.
Hmm.
Spoils of war. So anyhow, there was this massacre. Essentially to suppress any possibility of rebellion by the Polish people. And it wasn't until 1990 that the Russians did admit that it was Soviet troops and that there were orders from the Stalinist regime to commit this. So this is one of those sort of interesting Ministry of Truth questions. Is history simply written by the victors? Or does true history actually become relevant at some point? Is truth truth, as opposed to is truth whatever the winning, the victorious power makes it?
Hmm. Hmm.
Okay, so yeah, we seem to have exhausted that topic.
Yeah, I honestly don't know enough about the subject to have an opinion. I don't know enough about the I don't have enough context to really be able to say much, unfortunately.
Well, and I guess that's the point of what we try to do on the show here. You know,
yeah.
KPFT is a 501c3 organization, charitable tax deductible organization. Good to know if you're supporting the station.
Yes.
But a 501c3 is considered an educational nonprofit.
Yes.
And that's what Thinkwing Radio and other shows on KPFT try to be and try to do. We try to educate. We try to provoke thought and consideration and debate and discussion. So here we are.
Mm.
Okay, we've got a few more minutes, which can bring us to the next story, which I ran across on the Washington Post. And the title of this one is a little scary. Humidity and heat extremes are on the verge of exceeding the limits of human survivability, study finds.
Mm.
Humans cannot survive prolonged exposure to certain combinations of heat and humidity. And the article starts off, "Welcome to Steam Bath Earth," featuring sauna-like temperatures and humidity too high for humans to tolerate. Extremely humid heat is more intense than most Americans have experienced. You know, they talk about the Southwest, but it's dry heat. That's not necessarily helpful either. But apparently humid heat is even worse.
Yeah.
The study finds that what is called a wet bulb temperature, which is done by wrapping a wet cloth around a thermometer, it's explained in the article. A wet bulb temperature of 95 degrees or 35 degrees Celsius can render ineffective the human heat response of sweating, which is used by the body to shed heat through evaporation. This can lead to hyperthermia. In simple words, you overheat, you get heat stroke. And this is already occurring, this temperature, for short periods of time at a few weather stations. It's tending to occur in the Persian Gulf along shoreline communities. It's happening in coastal southwestern North America. Where, as they phrase it, I love this word, where sizzling lands border sultry seas. That sounds almost romantic, but apparently it's nearly fatal.
Well, yeah.
And it's also occurring in northern South Asia. So, I mean, the context in which to view this is Earth's mean temperature, its average temperature is rising. Now, remember, climate is not weather. Climate is a global thing or it's a regional thing, but it's not a daily thing.
Right.
Daily things are weather. So when we're talking about a temperature increase of 1.5 or 2 degrees centigrade, it's worth remembering that 1 degree centigrade is about 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit.
Right.
So if you think of 1 or 2 degrees as not being a big deal, think of it as 3 or 4 degrees, and that's enough to change your thermostat setting.
Yeah.
Now, will the Earth become uninhabitable? Will coastal communities be inundated with water from the ocean and from lakes, from melting ice? Yes, there's going to be all that. The question at this point in this article is not necessarily will the Earth become uninhabitable, but will regions of the Earth become uninhabitable? Will they become Death Valley, but with more humidity? And thus people, you know, it'll look a little like Arrakis and Dune, where maybe people will have to carry around essentially their moisture in a suit in order to stay hydrated and stay protected from the heat. You won't be able to go out unprotected for any length of time. If you've ever read Dune.
I haven't, but okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you should. It's like one of those things everybody should read just because it's such a part of popular culture and, and sort of subtle thinking in the popular mind. But this is sort of framed in a way that you don't hear much. You know, we think a lot about and we hear a lot about Earth's temperature rising 2 degrees. That, by the way, they mean centigrade. It's almost 4 degrees Fahrenheit. You hear about sea level rising 3 feet, 50 feet, 200 feet in 50 years, 100 years, 200 years. And those kinds of things, I think, while they're real and they're serious, you get to a point that humans have trouble actually conceptualizing it.
Yeah, it's like what happens when you try to describe how much money the richest people in the world have. I mean, most people can't comprehend $1 billion, not really.
I mean, $1 million used to be that number, but now it's like $1 million doesn't go as far as it used to. So $1 billion becomes the benchmark for something you really cannot comprehend. I think what this article does is instead of trying to make you think globally in ways that are not intuitive for humans to think, this gets you to think very specifically that there may be a part of your country that may no longer support human life for any length of time.
Yeah.
You know, that you come and you go, but you don't stay.
Yeah.
And I think that's a difference in conceptual thinking. It's no longer about will we destroy life on Earth? Will we end civilization on Earth? It's more like will there be more than one Death Valley on Earth?
Yeah.
Will we have death coastlines?
Yeah.
Will we have death basins? Will, you know, civilization will survive someplace, parts of it. It's just that there will be places where humans can no longer go. And if you think about it, this actually comes up in science fiction a lot, and even in astrobiology, when they talk about, well, this planet is tidally locked to its star, so the dark side is too cold for life, the lit side is too hot for life, but can life survive and evolve in the twilight parts? The Terminator zones, so to speak.
Right.
Where the temperatures are more moderate.
Yeah.
This is like one of those questions. Can Earth survive in some places where it's not too hot and humid for humans to survive while other places will no longer be habitable? And there might be life there, animals, plants of various sorts, scrub brush maybe, cactuses maybe, insects maybe, but just not humans.
Yeah.
So This is why I found this article compelling.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like, you know, people talk about terraforming worlds that we can't, in science fiction, of course, terraforming worlds that we can't live on out in space. But, I mean, imagine if that's what Earth was like. Imagine if there was no place where there were, you know, a limited number of places on Earth where we just humans couldn't survive for, you know, long periods of time without, you know, technological
supportive gear, the equivalent of scuba gear for these impossible environments. I'm about to create a new word. Are you ready?
Okay.
Terra deforming.
Terra deforming. Okay. Okay.
And is that what we are doing to certain areas of the Earth? Are we terra deforming these places where humans may no longer be able to exist because of the combinations of heat and humidity?
Hmm. Yeah.
Heard it here first.
Terra heard it here first. Well, probably heard it here first.
I'm pretty sure. You want to look it up?
Yeah, I may as well. I got a computer in front of me.
We have 1 minute and 40 seconds.
Hmm.
So this, well, he's typing very, very fast.
Terra deforming is a thing on TV Tropes, apparently.
Really?
Yes. People who try terra deforming see any area that is not housing humans, catering to humans, or creating resources for humans as wasted and views. Okay, so this is a different thing. It's about
wastelands is what this would be.
Yeah, it's about destroying natural habitats and viewing them as worthless because humans aren't on them.
Well, but destroying natural habitats because they're viewed as worthless doesn't mean converting them to some other use some people consider useful. Therefore, not really terra deforming in the same sense we're discussing here.
I'm seeing what I think is an art project entitled Terra Deforming, and the description is basically what you're describing. But the page isn't loading, and I don't know if I can quote the URL.
Well,
so.
We've got 35 seconds, so we might as well sign off. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston. My co-host and program editor, invaluably, is Andrew Ferguson.
Yes, yes, I am.
Remember, you can podcast Think Wing Radio. You can also listen online at kpft.org. You can go to my website and follow the articles that I cite, as well as listening to the pre-recorded shows at thinkwingradio.com. I hope everybody has a great week. I hope we haven't whipsawed you too much on the topic changes. Everybody take care, stay safe, stay healthy.
See you later.
Not too late, not while we're living. Let's put our hands out in time. There's got to be a morning after. We're moving closer to the shore. I know we'll be there by tomorrow.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, host of The Attitude, heard wicked early on KPFT 90.1 FM. I originate on a little community radio station, WNHN-FM in Concord, New Hampshire. But like our big brother, KPFT, this definition of community radio ties us together. Quote, "It should be made clear that community radio is not about doing something for the community, but about the community doing something for itself. In other words, owning and controlling its own means of communication." Close quote. I love this definition from AMARC Africa. So, folks, if you care about your community, you can show it by caring for KPFT 90.1 FM. Thanks for making The Attitude with Arnie Arneson part of the KPFT political talk. We love sharing the heat and the light. Big and bright, yeah, yeah. Deep in the
heart of Texas. If you decided to donate your birthday to KPFT this year, thank you. If your special day hasn't yet arrived, consider donating your birthday to KPFT. Here's how it works. Facebook sends you a prompt before your birthday asking if you'd like to donate your birthday to a nonprofit. Select KPFT as your organization of choice. Then add a personalized message so that your friends know how much KPFT means to you. On your birthday, they'll receive a Facebook notification asking them